This is Jason Horsley at the Limitless, the podcast between at horticulture.com. This week I'm talking to Jim Kunstler, the author of Living in the Long Emergency, Global Crisis, The Failure of the Futurist and the Early Adapters, who are showing us the way forward. Inside my chest. Been a while.
I should say.
It has been about a year according to Skype.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
How are you making out in BC?
Well, I imagine we might get to that because it seems as though we would make quite a good case study for your book if it wasn't too late for that, because actually our little thrift store is booming in the COVID crisis. So
isn't that great?
I think we found a model to ride the long emergency, even if it starts becoming a short emergency, although of course if the tanks start rolling down the streets, then things may change. And the main variable there the main bullet that we've dodged is that nobody's actually told us to shut down, which I believe has happened in other vicinities.
Have you had any virus there that you know of?
No, my wife and I, we ask many of our customers, we do a weekly survey, and we don't hardly encounter anyone who knows anyone, even.
How far are you from Vancouver?
About 2 hours.
Is that like 100 miles?
Probably a bit more than that, but yeah.
Wow.
Pretty close, yeah. Yeah, I know. It's quite confusing. I look at the news and even the local newspaper, and I hear one story, and I look around and I talk to people, and I get a whole other story.
So you must feel you're living in an alternative universe.
Yeah, parallel worlds.
What's the name of the town again?
Hope.
Hope, BC?
Yeah, it's kind of a joke. It's a town where Hope goes to die, because it's a truck stop town, you know, and most people just drive right through it, but it's a certain kind of person who arrives here and they don't leave because it has something. It's not exactly mysterious. It's got surrounded by beautiful mountains with two rivers intersecting, clean air, clean water. It's really got everything, right? But
yeah,
it's out of style.
Wow, yeah. You're really out. I'm looking at you on the map here. You're quite out in the beyond.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pioneer, frontier town, but it's on the edge of the wilderness, but at the same time, it's on the road to everywhere.
What's the main street? What's the high street
Wallace,
called?
Wallace Street.
Yeah. Wallace. Let's see. Wallace. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put that guy down there on Wallace Street and see what happens.
Yeah, that's where our thrift store is. We're right opposite the park, so we're well situated for traffic.
Quite beautiful.
It is, yeah.
The lunch bar, I see that.
Yeah, well, so many of the businesses, of course, have been suspended, including, I'm not sure about the lunch bar, but the cafes and obviously all the restaurants, they're all...
Oh, so they are. You are having a shutdown.
There is a shutdown, yeah, but we have managed to evade the umbrella of social control. We are, of course, technically we're a non-essential business. As far as we've heard, there's been one question on Facebook, like, why are those guys still open? Which was responded to with a chorus of praise of how essential we are because we give away food and clothing. And so it was shut down very quickly. And not only that, but it brought us more business as a result.
So, then it's more a matter of you guys are still open, even if the rest of Hope is not.
Boy, we were the last man standing. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
The landscape is beautiful. The town does have that kind of frontier sense, like the places in Australia where everything's like a one-story building.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been to Australia?
No.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of Australia where everything is just a kind of a tilt-up concrete building. and you know, everything's kind of, you know, there's no 19th century veneer anywhere, you know.
Right.
So.
Yeah, well, I just lucked into it. But yeah, we won't get into that because that's a whole story. But
Yeah.
yeah, it's a great place to be for this crisis. It's sort of ironic because we were talking about moving to Europe and going much more off the grid, and we still hope to do that. It's one of the reasons your book is such an interesting subject for me to talk about right now.
Okay.
But of course, with the current crisis, we don't even know if we can, and the Canadian dollar is bottoming out, and so there is these other geopolitical factors that may prevent it. We'll see. I fingers crossed. I'm quite optimistic, but in the meantime, we've got to see that hope actually is a good place to be in such a crisis, even if it's not entirely off the grid. So,
Well, what part of Europe were you thinking of trying out in?
Well, Italy or Spain are the main choices. I mean, there's Sicily, there's Portugal, but you may or may not know that you can buy entire villages in Europe for not for change, but you know, for what would the cost of an apartment in Vancouver kind of thing.
I've heard that, and even the place that I went for a couple of summers to visit my friend in Uzès, north of Nîmes. I was it's a stunningly beautiful town full of expats, including a lot of Anglo expats and Australian expats. And you can buy a gorgeous apartment there for like $250,000. And that's a place that is highly desirable, you know that. So the whole thing is really curious. I've been to the back of beyond up in like the Gorge du Tarn and the Massif Central, and there are whole villages up there that where there's nothing left, but they're beautiful fairy tale villages.
Yeah, well, of course the older generations are dying off, particularly now with this endemic epidemic, and the younger generations are not interested in living in the sticks as they would think of it. They're all, you know, cramming into the future smart cities. Well, good for them. That's definitely not the direction we want to go in, right? So, it seems like a golden opportunity if we can only get there. And there's whole villages for less than what you just quoted there for the apartment. I mean, it's small hamlet. We're talking about hamlet, so maybe three or four houses, but a lot of land, so one could grow trees and have a farm there and so on. And it just seems quite doable.
My only question would be, and I actually raised this in all three of my long emergency books, if you include Too Much Magic as one of them, is that I'm not so sure how orderly a place Europe is going to be. You know, it was certainly was nice in our lifetime. In fact, it was a darn theme park. But going forward, you know, you think about Europe being, you know, the slaughterhouse of the 20th century, and it almost seems incredible to look back on it, even though there, you know, there are like hundreds of movies about it and plenty of newsreels. But, you know, it's a daunting thing to imagine how disorderly Europe could become.
It is, but do you think that that's more the case in Europe than in North America?
Not necessarily, and you know, and it's also not it's not a certain destiny. You know, it's possible that maybe Europe can you know, become maybe Europe can do what it needs to do without falling into gross disorder and violence. So it's only a one possibility, but since we've already seen it happen once in modern times, it's not something you can easily discount.
So you're talking more about wars and kind of military violence as opposed to feudalism and a kind of Mad Max scenario.
Well, I could see it being a combo,
Huh.
you know, both, you know, both, you know, military conflict and an economic picture that more resembles in form. feudalism than what we've been through for the last 150 years or so, since the Napoleonic Wars, 200 years. Yeah.
Well, I mean, on that subject, it's really, what's the expression? I can't think of it offhand, but it's kind of flying by the seat of one's pants anyway. One really has to ride a wave of hope and faith. Unless one's going to refer to some sort of biblical prophecy maps or who knows what else, really. We're just trying to calculate as best we can. And what's happening to the economy now, I mean, I guess you're a man to talk to about this, but it's pretty hard to predict. It doesn't look good any way you look at it, and hence our idea about really being as little dependent on the system and on the economy as possible. Moving forward, you know, without having any illusions about being completely self-sufficient or off the grid, but at least to be closer to that end of the spectrum than the other end, and then be improvising within that as things accelerate to their certain doom.
Yes, I agree with all of those statements, that we are indeed in uncharted waters. It's very hard to predict where things go from now, from here. It is a bit ominous. The signs are at least telling us that we're not going to be in the same economy and society that we have enjoyed. The signs are that a certain amount of comfort and convenience may be leaving our lives. And it may be a good thing to dissociate ourselves from dependence on any, you know, large institutions or distant supply lines and relationships with things that are not in our immediate community. So, of course, it's very, very hard to rebuild local communities. You can do it schematically in your head and in conversation with other people. But when you really get on the ground and you have to really construct these practical arrangements, it's another matter. You know, I live in a county in upstate New York that's about 200 miles from New York City. And it's remains to mostly an agricultural county, although the nature of the agriculture has changed quite a bit over the decades. In fact, over the last three centuries, you know, it was originally settled by farmers who farmed. Many of their descendants left the area in the 1830s when the Midwest opened up and the soils were better out there, and it was flat out there, and it was just simply easier and more profitable to farm out there. And as soon as the communication routes were established in the way of water routes and roads, people moved there. And so my part of the country then reverted to mainly sheep pasturing. And, you know, we had been mixed farming and subsistence farming and became a sheep county. And that all changed around 1900 when the modern industrialized dairying system was invented with that it was comprised of the Holstein cow, which was a breed of cow that produced enormous amounts of milk, bulk refrigeration, which was due to electrification, and the electric milking machine. And, you know, you put those three things together, and, you know, you start to get a kind of industrial dairy farming thing. And that took over Washington County, New York, for about 90 years. And then starting in the 1980s or so, the dairy farms started crapping out. They couldn't compete with the larger operations in the Midwest and even as far as California. The small, locally owned, value-added operations like creameries started to close down. And food processing became much more centralized. And so they couldn't compete with the cheese making and stuff. And, you know, unlike places like France, where there was high value in localized products, we didn't have that in the U.S. You know, we didn't care whether our cheese was any good. or if it had any local character. All we cared for was whether there was a lot of it and it was cheap. And so, you know, we did not have the same kind of cultural armature that allowed that to happen. So anyway, around the 1990s, dairying started to crap out. And it's been kind of piecemeal. We've had piecemeal replacement with some artisan agriculture, you know, people growing table greens for the farmers markets and the restaurants. You know, here and there, somebody opens up a buffalo ranch or a, you know, and then after 5 years, they discover that buffaloes are wild animals and they're very dangerous to work around. So they quit that. And they turned their buffalo ranch into a wedding ranch, you know, where they redid the barn, the buffalo barn, if that's what if they even used it, you know, to hold weddings in. And now that the COVID virus has happened, you know, all of their events have been canceled. And in fact, just about everybody in the service industry who has made a buck doing events is now going out of business. So, you know, anyway, getting back to my county, so, you know, we're now in the artisanal phase of changeover from dairying to the next thing. I think that we will probably ramp up a more coherent and serious and better organized local agricultural economy with more value-added production, you know, more cheese, more creameries, more locally made stuff out of the stuff we grow here. And that will be good for this county. But, you know, the process is likely to be difficult and disorderly. No, right now, I'm trying to start conversations with some local people, and I found very interestingly that they're not interested in starting the conversation. Mm-hmm. I've tried it with a couple of, you know, ag people, farmers, tree guys. They just seem to be kind of demoralized and discouraged. But, you know, since societies are self-organizing and emergent, these relationships will form eventually as the needs become self-evident and people move in the direction of meeting the needs that are manifest and obvious. But it hasn't happened yet, and it's quite early in the game, right?
So was that was one of the impetuses of your new book, wasn't it? Having conversations with people, I guess not just locally, you were reaching nationwide, right? In order to see how others were perceiving the situation and adapting to it. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I was trying to get across the idea that we are in an epic transition to a new disposition of things. And that, you know, some people have obviously put a lot of thought and work into it. Not necessarily grand theory, but on the ground experience. You know, some of the people who I profiled in my book, and you know, the book is not just a book of profiles of people leading alt lifestyles. You know, it's basically a three-part book. The first part of the book addresses the kind of things that have changed since I wrote The Lung Emergency in 2005. And the central middle part of the book is are these portraits of what we call the early adapters. And the third part of the book is kind of a glimpse into the future and some discussions about culture and politics. And I was hoping to alert people that a change was coming down. And to show them some ways that individuals are meeting it. It's not a comprehensive view of the situation. The oddest thing of all, excuse me, I don't have COVID-19. The oddest thing of all is that the publication date of the book was virtually the day that the world got locked down, you know, or America joined the lockdown. And that might be defined as the day that the long emergency started in earnest, because that's when the economic damage became really obvious.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly a thought that I had coming into this conversation, is that your book became significantly more relevant in the time it took to get released.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, this is full of ironies because, the book got released just as the long emergency got kicked off. But that also meant that the bookstores, the few independent booksellers that are left, shut down.
Yeah.
And all the customers for books lost their incomes and revenue streams, so that they're much less likely to buy books. So, it's pretty ironic and strange, and I'm not going to get rich off of this.
You don't think that's balanced out by all these people at home and nothing to do, wanting more books?
Well, maybe a little bit, but yeah. They'll all be ordering books from Amazon. And as far as I'm concerned, as an author, Amazon has unusual special royalty agreements with their authors. We get much less from Amazon sales than we would from regular bookstore sales, because those are the deals that publishers cut with Amazon, and Amazon dominates the scene.
Yeah.
And like Standard Oil in the 19th century, they dictate the terms to everybody in the industry, and it's been ruinous for authors and hard for publishers. But that's the way it is. All the people in the arts have been affected in the last 10 years by the forces of computerization and globalization, and the music business has been just hammered into near extinction, in the sense that there's music out there, but not so much music business anymore. Certainly not the way it was when the Rolling Stones and James Taylor were making records and becoming millionaires back in the 70s.
Mm.
And the literary business followed them by about 10 years, and now it's almost impossible to make a buck writing.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the arts are, the movies, that's changed too. It's all moved to TV mostly. And I certainly had the feeling that the theatrical exhibition of movies was going extinct before the coronavirus came along.
Yeah.
We actually got by happenstance because the next substantial town near me is Saratoga Springs, where I lived for almost 35 years. And it's a town of about 30,000 people. And it's one of the few Main Street small towns in the Northeast that's actually healthy, that has a decent economy, or had a decent economy, mostly for kind of anomalous reasons. It had a small four-year liberal arts college. It had a smattering of other industries that kept on going, like a place that made electronic equipment for the military, and a bottling plant for spring water, and it had the famous Saratoga racetrack, which was a great tourist attraction, and it was very close to Interstate 87. And it thrived in a way that almost every other small town around here didn't. And so the bow tie Cineplex company built a 12-screen Cineplex here in 2014 or so. And I love to go to the movies, and I'm quite conditioned and habituated to do it, because I did it as a child growing up in Manhattan. I didn't have any woods to ramble around in, and I couldn't go bass fishing. I went to the movies every week. And I still like to do that. So I was going to the new Metroplex, the new Cineplex here in Saratoga regularly, and there was never more than like three or four people in the auditorium.
Right. Safe, in fact. COVID safe.
Well, it was, even pre-COVID. But it made me wonder, this company has opened a brand new 12-screen Cineplex and nobody goes to it. How long are they going to stick around?
Yeah.
So, that whole thing seems fraught. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling on, but this is kind of a rambly podcast, so I guess that's all right.
Hurt me. I live a life that never try. What I get free, you gotta buy. I'm proud of my life, don't ask me why. Cause if I told you, I'd probably
yeah, it is all right. I got many different talking points I want, but once the conversation gets going, we don't necessarily get to them. But so I'll just go where I want to go right now for now, and hopefully I'll remember the other ones. And this is more of it's like a general sort of big picture thing, which is to do with community and the relationship between community and business. And because it sounds from what you're describing about your whole county, like you have a sense of how things have evolved in your county, and so you're looking at the larger picture in terms of what the future might hold. And that's certainly not something that I feel confident in doing. It's kind of ironic because my family background is about international business, and even the creation of dairy and all that. So I, probably in my blood, I do have a lot of familiarity with that kind of larger entrepreneurial spirit. But in this particular life, all I have experience with is being rich, and then being very poor when I disinherited, and then gradually by sweat, blood and tears working my way back to solvency and stability not through writing, it won't surprise anyone, but through this thrift store business. And one of the things we've observed with this thrift store business is that the business model that works best is the one that serves the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been quite revelatory, because and my question has to do with whether you've thought about or observed that there's a natural way for communities, and I guess we have to say small communities now, because we've got this, now we have this global village where we're just, the whole system is kind of unified in some way.
Well, it was.
Well, okay, so it's fragmented and unified, but and I don't mean unified in the sense of harmony, but I mean homogenized. Let's say
sure,
it's homogenized.
Sure, I get it.
And so there's this idea that somehow, in order to survive as a species, we've got to all work together as 8 billion or whatever. I don't personally believe that's possible, but that's a kind of abstract point. But my question has to do with, have you thought about, or have you observed that when human beings do have a sense of community and they start interrelating in a community-based fashion, that business just naturally thrives out of that, like as in that together we cooperate in a way that benefits all of us, and that itself is a system that we've lost touch with, hence the current situation that we're in now.
Yeah, I take your point, and if you look at it historically, of course, there is a certain trajectory to the formation of communities and the interrelationships of their parts.
Hmm.
And, what we've been living through in the last 100 years is kind of anomalous, in the sense that, first of all of our activities in daily life in the advanced countries have been hypertrophied and accelerated by our energy supply. We had just this tremendous supply of oil, and before that, coal. And, one barrel of oil just performs the work of so many human hours of labor that it's almost out of this world.
Right.
And so, that was a supplement to all of the other things that humans can do. And it allowed us to elaborate a system of production and commerce that the world had never seen at that scale. And so one of the considerations that I think is real important is that we have to imagine that we're, you know, as we leave the high energy, the super complex world of that we're, you know, that we're now exiting behind, things are naturally going to be downscaled. So you have to think about, you know, things happening on a smaller scale. Now, I think just on a schematic basis, you can state that, first of all, societies are emergent and tend to self-organize around the circumstances that reality presents at a given time. And that economies and within societies, you know, compose a matrix of relationships that are both economic and social. And I think under the best circumstances, you know, you find yourself living in a community where you know the people who are doing business around you. You've got a kind of money that you can rely on that doesn't lose its value easily. You have people who occupy economic and social roles in the community. So not only do they are they caretaking of their own business, but they're caretaking of the people who work for them to a certain extent, and they're caretaking of the property in town. That, you know, in the USA, that's what's been so destructive over the last 30 years with the advent of, you know, giant shopping chain or retail chains and big box stores, is that, you know, all the money leaves the town. It's, you know, it ends up in one way or another in Bentonville, Arkansas, at the Walmart headquarters. Right. You know, when a town like mine in Greenwich, New York, when we had an active Main Street full of independently owned businesses, those people employed their neighbors. They took care generally of two pieces of property in town, the business property that they, you know, the building they did their business in, and their home. So they're taking care of two pieces of property. They often, the owners often perform civic duties, you know, by sitting on the boards of the hospital and the library and the school, and they support the institutions that way. And, you know, and you have a rich kind of matrix of institutions as well. And when you remove all those relationships, you know, you get the kind of desolation that you see in American small towns today. Right. So, you know, the question is, you know, how do you get people to occupy both social and economic roles by having businesses that perform locally, that employ people locally, that have relationships with people locally and support local institutions? And that really is the community part. There's one other element too, and it tends to be at odds with much of the ideology of our time, especially the ideology of the progressive left, which is that human beings tend to be hierarchical. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort themselves out in layers, and you know, personally, I believe that that's just the natural order of things. There are some unappetizing aspects to it, or can be, but it doesn't have to be wholly unappetizing. You know, it is, in fact, the natural order of things. Human beings are hierarchical. Some people have more stuff than other people. Some people have more responsibility than other people. Some people discharge their responsibilities better than other people. And, you know, you form a community that operates successfully by hashing out those kinds of relationships, those kinds of privileges, and those kinds of allegiances. And, you know, it is possible to get to a point where you have a fairly stable society. Living in the 20th century with all of the things I mentioned before that have accelerated the powers of production and commerce, you know, have been highly destabilizing of everything, including the relations between the classes in society. And as we move away from there, I think that we're liable to enter a period of a lot of economic and social disorder. And that is also, in some ways, part of the natural order of things. And, you know, the more complex and richly interdependent and fragile the system becomes, the more susceptible that system will become to destructive disorder when parts of it fail. And that's really where we're at now. And we're just beginning to see the failure of these components of our society, you know, the long distance supply lines and the production lines and the distribution lines. And as those things fail and it becomes difficult for people to make a living and to get the products they need and get the food they need, you know, the natural outcome of it is liable to be pretty disorderly.
Hmm.
But, you know, that's why I think it is probably beneficial to understand that this thing will be rebuilt on a smaller scale and to put yourself in a place that offers a smaller armature of daily life so that there's less to break down and it's easier to rebuild as circumstances require.
Hmm. Well, I think that it's also much harder to see the problems that are really endemic when things are on such a macro scale and they're so dependent on technology rather than just one-on-one or one-on-several human interaction, that it gets harder and harder to see the root cause of the problem, which has to be some kind of human dysfunctionality. I mean, you said that societies emerge somewhat organically. Well, the organic element there would be human beings, wouldn't it? Not only. The interface between human beings and the environment, that's all organic. So then society comes out of that organic interface. And one of the things I've been exploring in recent years, as you know, is the influence of trauma on the human nervous system and the psyche and how that manifests in pathologies, and then those pathologies of course create pathological societies. So I think, you know, what occurs to me, what you're describing there is that for me the symptoms we're seeing now were always obvious. I mean, I'm 50 years old, and I would say there's no time in my life where I didn't see society as profoundly dysfunctional. It's just that if you think of a body that's sick, if we're not really paying attention, it's only when it's in the critical stages that we notice it. Whereas in fact, that sickness has been, you know, brewing for a long time and has been manifesting in the symptoms for a long time. And that's how I see the society we live in, that it's probably, I mean, I tend to, when I try and trace it back, I find myself in the Garden of Eden. You know, I can't trace it far enough back in history, like when the problem began, without ending up in mythology. That seems to me how far back it goes.
Yeah. Well, I can see quite a distinction between growing up in the UK in the 1960s and 70s and me growing up in the USA in the 1950s and 60s. And, you know, in my childhood, that is, you know, being a pre-adolescent, the apparent stability was pretty strong in the USA. It doesn't mean it was stable or really truly non-pathological, because there was a great deal of pathological activity that was quite violent and it was already underway. You know, when I think about witnessing the suburban onslaught in the suburbs of Long Island outside of New York City in the 1950s, that was an unbelievably violent paroxysm of destruction. And yet, you know, living in the society of President Eisenhower and the 1950s and TV and Leave It to Beaver and the stability of the school system and to some extent the the integral stability of an American common culture, which was still operating, things did seem to be quite stable. I can see it would be quite different for you growing up in the post-war UK with all of the trauma of two world wars behind you, the impoverishment of the British Empire and really the loss of empire, and not to mention the peculiarity of your own family.
Well, yes, right. Absolutely.
I mean, those are all very kind of decadent forces.
Would you disagree, though, in a general way, that what we're seeing now has been coming down the pipe for quite a long time? I mean, prior to the 50s, that you could go back.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And there are many ways of, there are many lenses you can look through to see that. I'm not sure that I would agree with you if you did make this point, and I'm not altogether sure you did, that human beings are by nature some kind of pathologically programmed species. I think that that's not altogether true, but we've done an awful lot to create unhealthy circumstances for ourselves.
Yeah, no, I wasn't making that point. I think if I was trying to get to a point, and I probably should lay my cards on the table here, it's that my sense is that the solution, and I think you do, I don't know if you go, you dance around it or you, but it's there in your World Made by Hand series, that the solution, it seems to me, is not primarily a social or an economic or much less a political solution, but an existential solution, if I can be more neutral, or a spiritual solution. That there's some kind of spiritual ennui, some kind of original trauma in the human psyche that has led us to this point. And that it seems to me that the way that we're going to intuit and improvise our way to a solution is very much dependent on rediscovering a way to connect and relate to one another as human beings that is much closer to something empathic and something truly loving, and that has, for lack of a better word, a spiritual dimension to it.
I would agree with that. I actually lately would frame it a little differently from my point of view. I've been kind of preoccupied with the amazing, pervasive, immersive dishonesty that our culture has fallen into. And I think that what you call a spiritual argument might have to be reframed as a moral argument.
Sure.
And really having to do with people regaining some notion of what it means to do the right thing and to lead an upright and honest existence, because we are not doing that. And, you know, we're lying to ourselves constantly in the service of, you know, maintaining our current arrangements, and it's not working. And it's obvious at every level. And In the USA, which is somewhat different from Canada and other advanced countries, those pathologies are just vivid. You know, to me, I've said this more than once on other people's recordings, but the fact that education and medicine in our society are two activities that have managed to make themselves among the most dishonest rackets is an amazing thing. Because those might have been the two last places you would have looked for pervasive, thoroughgoing dishonesty and racketeering. And by racketeering, of course, I mean explicitly making money dishonestly. But here you have education, which has partnered with the federal government to create this dreadful racket of college loans, which has placed an entire generation in jeopardy of becoming debt slaves, has in fact made them debt slaves. And there's really no way out for them other than, you know, some real drastic remedy like a debt jubilee or just dismissing all the loans, and even that has consequences. So you there you have education, which has failed in the sense of turning itself into a financial racket at the same time that it's turned into an intellectual racket, you know, with all of its monstrous gender and race, I'm not even sure what to call them, games, hustles, really, is what they are. They're hustles. You know, so you've got the intellectual climate of the universities now has devoted itself to race and gender hustling, which is fundamentally dishonest. And, you know, the other half of the university devoting itself to money grubbing. And so education is now that we are in the COVID contraction, if that's what we might call it.
Yeah.
One of the first things that's happening very, very vividly in the news is that colleges are foundering. You know, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal today that said something like 200 colleges, small liberal arts colleges, are apt to shutter over the next year because the current situation has been so ruinous to them. You know, a lot of these institutions were teetering on the edge of solvency already, but this is really pushing them over the edge. So, you know, all of what we've just described has led to what is apt to be the failure of higher education on a very broad-based way. And then, of course, there's medicine, which in the United States has turned into the most cruel and odious racket imaginable, where people, you know, people go into the emergency room with an injury, you know, and they require 7 stitches to close up a wound, and they end up 60 days later getting a bill for $27,000 or some just outlandish, fictional, made-up dollar figure that, you know, that has no rational basis in anything other than the wish of a large corporation to grub as much money from its victims as possible. So what they've actually turned medicine into is a hostage racket, because the people who go to the healthcare system are generally people who are in trouble with their health. And, you know, worrying about whether you're going to die or not is a pretty dire kind of mental state to be in. And when they've got you and you're in that state, they can do pretty much whatever they want to do in terms of extracting money from you. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, now, look, understandably, some people are insured and some people get covered, but, you know, they're paying ridiculous amounts of money. I'm, you know, one of our blogging cohorts, Chris Martinson, disclosed that you know, his family was paying $28,000 a year for family health insurance policy. $28,000 a year is, it, I think, almost comparable to the median American income. Mm-hmm. You know, $28,000 is—it's like an outlandish amount of money. And anyway, so we've got these two activities, which, you know, ought to be upright, honest activities, and that's exactly what they're not. You know, education is based on the supposedly on the pursuit of truth, and medicine is dedicated to the proposition that you first do no harm. Mm-hmm. And they are both utterly betraying their missions. And those are only two activities in America. But the fact that they are two of the worst afflicted with dishonesty tells you a lot about the pervasive dishonesty of our culture.
Yeah, well, you're describing an inversion there, not just a perversion, but an inversion. They become the opposite of what they're purported to be about. And
quite right.
As you infer, that it could be extended to, I mean, I would suggest just about every other institutionalized service provide, you know, that there is. And even occurs to me entertainment, which I've written a lot about, that its purpose is quite nefarious too, because it's supposed to just, you know, lighten our load, but actually it's geared towards propagandizing and indoctrination. So again, it's an inverted function. That it's supposedly, it's offering one thing and it's doing another. And I mean, that's quite, you can see why the Christians would think that the planet was run by Satan. I mean, it's definitely it's an easy blanket argument, right?
But I think your larger question about, you know, what is it on the macro human scale that's driving that kind of perversity? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, and to bring it back to what you started with, you supplanted spirituality for morality. Well, I'd agree that they're synonymous, but I'd also say that both of those words have been debased. They're both tricky words. So
yes, they are.
Yeah, because spirituality has become spiritualized egos and displacement activities and New Age fantasies and just a dissociated kind of relationship to
existence. Yeah, and a great deal of neurosis as well.
Yeah, and morality, as we know, has become moralism and you know, kind of virtue signaling and all the rest of it. So then I think it's worth staying on this for a bit, which is the question of what these things are pointing to, why you feel you need to use the word moral sometimes or morality, and I feel I need to use the word spirituality, even though I don't like either word particularly, because of the reasons I've just described, but that there is something inherent in existence that we can access as human beings, which I'd say is right relationship to reality, and that with that comes these things that we've named, and then of course they've become industrialized and commercialized and perverted and inverted. So it's this endlessly nefarious subterfuge that's going on. But underneath all of that, it seems to me that there is this opening for a profound shift in our awareness. For me, it starts with the body very much. Like the more we can start to really tune into our bodies and the life force. And my sense is that life force is conscious and intelligent, and it has its way of being in nature and in existence. Why wouldn't it? It does with animals, so why not with humans? And that from there, as we tune into our bodies, we're able to connect to other human bodies more and to nature. And then from there develops this thing that we don't actually have a word for, because we wouldn't need a word for it if only we hadn't lost it.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that we are quite out of tune with our bodies. And a lot of it has to do with, processed food that we eat and the activity of, you know, sitting in front of an electronic screen all day and not moving around and being exposed to chemicals and living in a toxic environment
even the architecture, you know, that you've written a lot about.
Oh, and yes, the things we surround ourselves with, which in the USA, this is also very true in Canada, no question about it. You know, living in environments that send you a message all the time that you are, you know, that you're living a kind of in a death wish culture. Hmm. You know, I may have said this before, but the immersive ugliness of the American built landscape really has to be understood as entropy made visible. And entropy is that force in nature that you don't want to fuck around with. It's dangerous. It's the force in nature that propels things towards stasis and death. Mm. And so the message from living in this immersively entropic environment, full of buildings that are meaningless, if not hateful and baleful, the consequence of that is soul killing and spirit killing. And to get that message that you're constantly toiling in the presence and service of death, and all of its agencies, the things that associate with death, you know, that's a terrible message. And that's what we're sending ourselves constantly. And it's amazing that Americans are as resilient as they are to even be able to function in all that. You know, I traveled a lot when I was back on the lecture circuit. I went to every backwater in America and every frontwater in America and every suburb in America, every miserable place from, you know, the wasteland between Dallas and Fort Worth and the asteroid belt of incomprehensible suburban crapola outside of Minneapolis and Des Moines and Chicago and everywhere. I've seen it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it amazes me that people can withstand the spiritual brutality of these environments that they live in. I think it's taken a toll, and it's one of the reasons that we have become a nation of pervasive dishonesty, because we can't even find any kind of an anchor for our values. And we, you know, other than the bullshit that is broadcast on TV, and it's made it very difficult for people to understand what it means to be an upright human being.
Yeah, the dearth of beauty.
Yeah, or to be just, you know, to be associated with things that are life-giving, not life-draining. And, you know, it's probably been more of a battle in our time for individual psyches than maybe at any other time in human history. I would think that the tendency towards neurosis is just greater than one could ever imagine before. And, you know, it's produced a culture in which it's produced a culture that seems to be just plumb crazy.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the terror management theory, the Sheldon Solomon thing inspired by the Ernest Becker?
You'll have to remind me. You know, I know Sheldon. He lives in Saratoga. He's a Skidmore professor.
Right.
I've known him for 35 years. I haven't been that close to him. But I have heard this. But you have to remind me exactly how it works.
Well, it's very simple, or at least how I'm going to describe it to you is very simple. Anyway, it's the Ernest Becker book is Denial of Death, and his thesis is that the whole culture of human activity is driven by the fear, the denial of death, you know, the fear of death that isn't healthy fear, because you could say there's a healthy fear of death that helps us survive, there's a necessary awareness of death, but this is something else, this is a fear that combines with denial, you know, and suppression of the awareness of it. And so, Sheldon Solomon and this institute, if that's what it is, have come up with the terror management theory to extend it into the different ways and do a lot of, you know, field research or lab testing or what have you on human beings, not exactly laboratories, but, you know, to see the ways in which human beings will behave differently if they're made aware of death in a way that they're not able to process it, if you see what I mean.
So absolutely. And not only that, it's perfectly obvious that if you are preoccupied with death and annihilation, you know, that is going to produce a nihilistic tendency in people's psyches. And I think that's very much what we're describing in contemporary American, Canadian, you know, Western North American culture.
Yeah. Well, one of the variables I wanted to add there is not only would it drive human beings and societies to create death-oriented cultures, but that it drives them into over-activity. because they're actually, in order to keep death out of awareness, we get mindlessly busy doing whatever we can to make our lives feel meaningful, which is nihilistic. It's mm-hmm. a kind of paradox, actually, that nihilism is often drives people into achievements. We could say great achievements, but I think we're both on the same page here, but there isn't that much great at the end of the day about our society and culture. You know, the dark stuff vastly outweighs the light stuff. And I mean, we could even make that contrast, like there are things in art that deal with death, and they can be cathartic and healing and inspiring. Yeah. Dostoevsky or Shakespeare, or pick your favorite artist, they probably deal with the dark side of human existence, but in a way that helps us reconcile ourselves to it, whereas the majority of human activity is the opposite.
Well, there's another force there that I think we left out, which is, you know, it's not just a valence between death and hyperactivity, but there's another set of forces that revolve around joy and beauty and the apprehension of the gratitude for being in this world.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, one of the signal features of the entropy saturated environments that we live in is the astounding absence of grace notes, of attempts to create beauty, of attempts to remind ourselves why it matters to be in this world at all, and what the universe offers in the sense of compensations for the tragic nature of being itself. You know, the fact that we are aware that we come into this world and we leave this world. Mm. And it is those grace notes and that apprehension of the need to be grateful for being alive and the expressions of beauty that are the vehicle for that are so absent in our lives. I mean, it's particularly obvious in what passes for the fine arts these days, you know, where they're only preoccupied with either propaganda or creating gags and jokes and pranks, often, you know, at the expense of the viewer. And coincidentally, a great deal of ugliness in the process. So, you know, we are in a culture that, in a way, has become incapable of producing art. And it's one of the reasons, for example, that I approach my blogging the way I do, which I think may be lost on a lot of the people who read my blog. But it's a very conscious attempt to produce something of literary artistry, as well as trying to make a point twice a week. Even if people don't apprehend it directly, I think it's one of the things that has made it a successful blog.
Right. Well, I brought that up with my wife just recently, yesterday. I'm talking to you because she mentioned that you have an orientation towards beauty, and we kind of agreed that you keep it under wraps because a lot of the time you focus on the dark side of things, as do I do in different ways.
But I try to do it with artistry.
Well, that was what we also zeroed in on, is that you communicate the aesthetic. You have an aesthetic of beauty.
Yeah.
So it's there in the medium being more important than the message, you could say.
Also, you know, I take very seriously Samuel Beckett's dictum that nothing is funnier than unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, you know, to me, that's the basis of an awful lot of comedy. You know, comedy is to some extent based on the fact that people are uncomfortable with the subjects of comedy. And that is really what is behind, you know, provoking laughter. And so the things that I write about are things that make me and a lot of other people very uncomfortable, you know, especially the man-made landscape around us. And, you know, it's such a rich vein to mine for ridicule,
uh-huh.
you know, and if you bring some skill to the act of ridicule, it's just a fantastically interesting artistic enterprise.
That was the name that Balzac gave to his novels, wasn't it? La Comédie Humaine, the human comedy.
And you know, it's true. Nothing is funnier than unhappiness. When you see a Charlie Chaplin movie, and somebody knocks him down, and he pops up again, and he gets knocked down again, and pops up again, we laugh. But if somebody really popped you in the head, you know, in real life, that would be pretty unpleasant. You know, when Stan hits Ollie with a 2x4 or drops a piano on him, you know, that would be pretty unpleasant and unhappy in real life. And yet that is the substance of their comedy. And it's very rudimentary comedy, but, you know, it just demonstrates the point. Hmm. Nothing's funnier than unhappiness.
Well, I suppose the optimal thing is that if one can see the funny side of one's own unhappiness, then one is liberated from it. Then, and that's,
well, it's one of the sources of joy in life. That's true. It is a bit of an inversion, but it's nonetheless. Life is full of strange paradoxes.
Well, yeah, because I appreciated that you said the tragedy of human tragedy is being aware that we're going to die, because I think that's more accurate than to say it's a tragedy that we're going to die, because then it would be compared to what, right? Everything dies, so how could that be tragic? Sure. It's not, right? But there's something in our awareness, and maybe the tragedy, again, back to this terror management thing, is that we've lost the ability to accept death and or to contemplate the eternal, whatever form that would take. It's become a source of terror to us in the secular age, whereas it used to be a source of beauty and awe.
And we've left those consolations behind. Mm. And those consolations were very rich, very, very, very spiritually nourishing.
Well, do you find as a, I don't know how you describe yourself, but I know you're not a religious man. Do you find that there is a way for you to contemplate eternity that does give you joy even without any of the mental consolations of religion?
Yeah, I do. Although I think mine might be pretty prosaic. You know, there's nothing terribly complicated about them. You know, I'm just aware that it's important to be grateful to be here. Mm. You know, Wittgenstein said it pretty succinctly. He said, "It's astonishing that anything exists."
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I find that I don't have to be it's not difficult for me to prompt myself to realize that I'm grateful to be here. I'm closer to the end than I was to the middle, mm-hmm. than I am to the middle. But you know, not only am I here now, but I was here for all those years before. Mm-hmm. And nothing will change that I was here. And I also think take a certain amount of consolation in the notion that time is not exactly what we apprehend it to be, what it seems to be. Mm-hmm. That there time actually has elastic properties that are hard to demonstrate, but are nonetheless there. And so those are the kinds of things that I take consolation in, apart from, you know, the prosaic joys of the beauty around me and trying to create a few things that are beautiful. You know, whether it's a nice meal or to go out and paint a picture, because I'm a serious painter. Mm-hmm. I'm seriously involved in that, you know, form of expression. I do it regularly. I am a big believer in doing these things as disciplines and practices. You know, there are certain things that I can't get myself to do as practices. It's very hard for me to get myself to do yoga, mm-hmm. because it hurts my aging body. But I can get myself out and stand in front of an easel outside, sur le motif, for 3 hours without too much distress. And I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction out of that. And I take a lot of satisfaction from composing prose. And, you know, and I like to cook. And so, you know, these little daily ceremonies in life are very important to me. And, you know, if I was actually more a part of that culture of, you know, commuting and getting crappy takeout food from some, you know, from some store every night, you know, it would be different.
Mm-hmm. I found myself speculating on your star sign there, Jim, which is probably a question that you've never been asked on a podcast.
I'm not on a podcast, but yeah, I think that astrology is fun, but I don't really know much about it, or, you know, I don't follow it much. I'm a Libra. Huh. I was born on at 7:20 in the morning on October 19th, 1948. I have no idea what that signifies.
Wow, you just gave the time, did you?
I did.
Yeah, so because my wife's an astrologer, but any astrologers out there, when this airs, will be getting busy if they're interested.
Okay. And I was born in New York City.
Well, Libras, whatever. You know, sorry to cut you off, but Libras, that's particular appreciation of beauty is a Libran quality. So.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, very much so. Harmony, beauty and harmony, which is kind of where I was getting to with beauty. I felt like maybe that's a better term, actually, than spirituality and morality, a sense of beauty. And what you're describing there is, I think it's innate in human beings, and it contrasts beautifully with this top-heavy human, the nihilistic human, who often, in many cases, doesn't even recognize that he's nihilistic, or she, because it's so endemic to the culture. That top-heaviness turns death into something it's not, as in something to fear, that we can think about of how terrible it is that I'm going to die. But actually, if we're in the body and in the present, well, we're not dying and we're not dead. So it's really an irrelevant concern. It's an irrelevant preoccupation unless we're telegraphing outward with our intellects.
Well, there's also the idea that death is nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is nothingness, but it's also nothing.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to fear.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to get too metaphysical about it. I'm not that much of a metaphysician, despite what we've been talking about today. But I'm willing to venture into that realm.
Yeah. Well, I know I have to be careful teasing it out of you, because I wouldn't want you to sully your reputation as a hard headed nuts and bolts guy that I know that you are. But at the same time, I like, you know, probably people who follow you are interested in this side of you.
Do you remember Henry Mencken's definition of a metaphysician?
No.
A blind man stumbling around a dark cellar looking for a black cat that isn't there.
It's Schrodinger's cat, probably. Yes, well, I mean, yes, it can get there. And again, if it becomes, you know, like a sandpit for the intellect to play in, then I think it does more harm than good. But I think we all have an inherent sense of that. You were saying this about time. Time isn't what it seems to be, maybe. And that means nothing is what it seems to be once you put time, you know, question mark after time.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, then everything becomes mysterious. And so, you know, our sense of physical reality and what the body is, all these things are question marks if we're honest about them.
Well, speaking of black cats, you know, and I'm noticing that your logo on Skype is a black cat.
Yes.
So about 2.5 months ago, I adopted two black cats from one of the people who I wrote about in my book, Suzanne Slauman, who is the artisan baker in Vermont, who a very brave girl who really impressed me. And she lives up in the Mad River region of Vermont and is a wonderful baker. She's a commercial baker, but an artisan baker. And she had two cats that she wanted to rehome because they had been left with her by an erstwhile boyfriend. Mm-hmm. Who was now gone. or then gone. Anyway, my excellent cat had passed away around Christmas time at the age of 16. And I was all for adopting two cats. So Suzanne brought the cats over, and they immediately went into hiding. And they hid in their hidey holes in my house, you know, for day after day, week after week. They would come out and eat at night when I wasn't around, but they would just not come out. And then one night they came into my bedroom and they got on the bed and they rolled on their backs and let me tickle their stomachs and let me pet them, and they purred. And I thought, oh, that's great. I can finally put the pet door in the window. I had this unit that I purchased when I adopted them, which was a pet, you know, a pet door that has kind of a, you know, plastic flap in it. Mm-hmm. And so I installed it, and the next day they vamoosed.
Oh, no.
But they have been coming in for dinner every night for the last 9 weeks or whatever it's been.
Yeah.
Every night they come in for dinner, more than once, and I have a way of testing that because I put little cat treats on the platform in front of the landing of their flapped window door. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen them for all that time. Haven't laid eyes on them.
Wow.
I've got two black cats I never see. They're extremely low maintenance except for feeding.
Yeah.
And they're extremely low reward.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't you miss that? Now that you had a taste of honey with them on the bed that one time,
yeah,
it seems a shame, doesn't it? So
they, well, Suzanne says that they behaved that way twice at her house. They did that. They went into hiding for months when she first brought them in, when her ex-boyfriend brought them in. And then when she got a dog, they went into hiding for another couple of months.
Right.
And then they kind of normalized and started hanging around and, you know, sitting on the furniture and being nice. Hmm. So I live in hope that some sort of cat-human relationship will be established.
Will develop. Well, come winter, they may find they're a little more human-centered.
I hope so. I have a wood stove. It's very comfortable. There's a nice little love seat right next to it. And they're welcome to stay.
Thank you.
That sounded like a wind-up, but I did have, I mean, a winding-up.
No, I'll go on for a bit more.
Yeah, good, because I do have at least two more things I wanted to get to.
Sure.
One is a follow-on from where we were before the cats, and that is to do with monastic life. I can maybe unpack it a bit more if you want, but have you looked into monastic life, not for you personally, but just in terms of how it worked and how it still does, I suppose, and what kind of correlation it has, if any, with ways of living in the coming years?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And you know, in history and literature, we can see that the monastic life is a kind of a device or solution for civilizations that have gotten themselves into trouble. Because what you get is, you know, you get a collection of men or you know, in the case of, I guess, the nuns or something like that, you know, you get a collection of women who dedicate themselves to crafts that involve the preservation of culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the most famous literary example of that, I guess, is the great sci-fi novel of the 1960s, I think, called A Canticle for Leibowitz, which takes place in a monastery deep in the future and involves a monk who is trying to preserve the culture that has vanished. But, you know, we can see that also, obviously, in, you know, the history of the aftermath of the fall of the Roman Empire and what happened in Europe. And, you know, human beings organize themselves in this kind of lifeboat society of monasteries. They're self-sufficient. They're very cleverly organized towards fairly simple ends. They produce things that are fairly plain and straightforward, you know, like wine or some kind of food product, you know, mm-hmm. cheese or something. Or, you know, they dedicate themselves to an art form, like, you know, the illumination of holy manuscripts or, you know, whatever the Buddhists produce in the way of artifacts. And, you know, they're kind of placeholders, I think, for more complex social organisms during a time of great social retrenchment, when the greater armatures of life, like city life, contract and fade away and dissolve, the armature of the monastery is can be supported more easily. And that's how I see it.
Hmm. Well, when you say placeholders, do you think that's necessarily the case, and is it possible that could be the optimal state, and that the complexification is more?
I wouldn't call it the optimal state. No, I actually wouldn't, because you know, the fact that the monastery implies a lack of any kind of male-female relations,
well, but okay,
to me makes it really humanly incomplete.
No, well, that's true.
In a major way.
I was definitely going to make that proviso, because my wife and I have talked about for years, like, setting up some kind of secular monastic arrangement, and that does seem to be where we would be going if we did get a large enough property in Europe, say, not in the sense of, certainly not separating of the sexes, but just in the set, all the positive things you said there, including, yeah, which you didn't mention, the focus on the eternal, like that's the thing that keeps those communities together, is that they're all focused on something that's not of this world, it seems to me.
Well, in a time of great quietness,
yeah,
you know, when the great grinding wheels of civilization have stopped,
yeah,
that will very easily propel you into a contemplation of the eternal.
Yeah. Well,
but I, you know, there's one other thing I want to say about that. Now that you mention what you've been thinking about, you know, setting up a community, because another thing that I've been really interested in as a literary thing over the years were the utopian communities of the 19th century in America.
Yeah.
And also, when I was a newspaper reporter, I was I put a lot of energy into investigating religious cults and that was not exactly the same thing, but, you know, it was related. Right. So, you know, in America, especially being this new world where, you know, everything was fresh and including making fresh starts. And a lot of people came to America with fantasies of starting utopian communities. And a lot of Americans who were already here had fantasies about doing it. And the mid-19th century was an extremely fertile time for utopianism.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you mix the men and women together, things get kind of dicey.
Yeah, I know.
And
yeah.
Utopian communities tend to founder on, you know, on either financial conflict and irregularities and sexual conflict and competition.
Yeah.
The Shakers tried to eliminate that. You know, they had some screwed up kind of workarounds like, you know, bundling. They had this practice called bundling where people would, you know, men and women would be able to sleep together, but, you know, have barriers between them in bed. You know, completely insane as far as I'm concerned. You know, I mean, you wonder how many of those bundlers just, you know, ditched the bundles and got it on.
Did you notice if there was any thing around numbers there, if any of these communities or these attempted communities considered a limit to the number or the possibility that once you get past a certain number, then things start going to hell?
I don't remember exactly if any of them did. I would rather imagine that they did, although some of them were really grand, like the Fourierists, the followers of Fourier, mm-hmm. who is a kind of a French crank theorist. And he had quite comprehensive scheme that involved these massive architectural structures, these megastructures that he called phalansteries.
Mm-hmm.
And they essentially looked like 19th century universities look. You know, just great buildings full of barracks and workrooms and workshops and laboratories and common rooms and stuff. And, you know, they resembled physically what we would think of as, you know, like an Oxfordian college. But anyway, his ideas spread to America, and they wanted to build these giant phalansteries in the USA. And, you know, he imagined thousands and thousands of people living in these places. But, you know, there's also that idea, which is, it doesn't really come out of utopianism. It's the idea that the really optimum number of people in a group to, you know, to cohere successfully is something like 150 people.
Okay.
And what we would probably call a village.
Yeah, that seems very high to me. Interesting about Fourier, he's same birthday as me. That's how I know who he is. I mean, it's not the only reason, but when I came upon him, I noticed he had my birthday. So I do remember him because of that. So, yeah, there's probably a warning there about utopian dreams if you're an Aries. But my sense is that the problem, obviously, men and women together is going to cause problems. Yes, it's true. But the thing that I can see that would be, if it was carefully restricted, might avoid many of these problems is the numbers thing. Because if you think about it, a man and a woman living together, obviously that can be fraught, but assuming that they can harmonize,
yeah.
And I've been married 10 years now, so it can be done. That's no problem, right? So then you bring a couple more, whether it's children or brothers and sisters and so on, right? There's a certain point where the numbers start getting unwieldy, and well, not unwieldy, but the interrelational dynamics and the emotional and the status jockeying, whatever we're going to call that, that starts coming into play gets more than you know, the community can withstand. So what I wonder is whether there's an, If we look at other animals, they do have a natural kind of social, in quotes, organization. It very much is around numbers.
That's an interesting other element of the story, actually, which we touched on before, which is the question of hierarchy. And utopian communities tend to be allergic to hierarchy,
right?
And yet they are nonetheless subject to it.
They
often founder on the question of hierarchy and authority.
I was going to bring that up too with monastic. Do you think that monastic living, I mean, how much do you think monastic living gets around the hierarchical problem, if at all?
Well, it's simple. You know, it's really simple, is that the hierarchy is simple. You know, there's the guy in charge, and then everything else is pretty much based on, you know, the you know, how long you've been in the order.
Right. Isn't it also to do with your functions and your roles?
Well, I don't know that I don't know enough about it to say that. I think one of the, when you're talking about monasteries, like Christian monasteries,
for example, yeah,
it seems to me that what characterizes them is that you know, the work is equally done among all of the members, all of the brothers.
Yeah,
and so it's not a hierarchy of function necessarily. Yeah. It's probably more a hierarchy of, you know, time served, and then there's one head honcho, you know, the abbot or the
abbot. Yeah, I spent some time with the Benedictines, not long enough to, you know, get a sense of.
Oh, you know more about it than I do then.
Yeah, but yeah, there was an abbot, and so yeah, if there's a boss, there's a hierarchy. Yeah. One thing I wonder about this is how much of our sense of hierarchy is to do with a social set of values, so that we perceive, we turn something into a hierarchy that really isn't. So if you think of a community, or even in this case like a monastery, supposing you've got one monk who takes out the garbage is one of his jobs, and you've got another monk who works on preserving manuscripts. Well, in our society, with our value set, we would see the garbage monk as lower, but that wouldn't necessarily extend to the monastic community itself. It would depend, and this would be the function of the eternal or God as being the principle that's, you know, the whole thing's revolved around, because everybody is equal in the context of eternity or God.
Well, in fact, you know, in monasteries, or at least in religious orders, you often get a kind of inverse hierarchy, in that the you know, the highest and best thing you can do is the lowest kind of labor, right?
Yeah.
So the humbler you are, the more godly
exactly,
you are perceived to be.
Yeah, so that's a great way of subverting that thing.
But you raise another interesting question, which is, you know, what is it in the nature of authority that makes authority, that inclines people to vest that authority. And I think that the answer to that is that you know, authority has to essentially, to be true and real, authority to some extent has to really be honest. And it gets back to the idea of living in, when we live in a culture of pervasive institutionalized dishonesty, then authority no longer has meaning, and it's very hard to vest and invest figures with authority. We're seeing that very clearly in the USA today, where, you know, our country is so dishonest and so afflicted with dishonesty that, you know, we have these two characters who are going to be the, as of now, in May 1st, 2020, who are going to run for president. You know, the Democratic, putative Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, is clearly not mentally fit for the job. And yet you've got the whole hierarchy of the party and all of its rank and file vested in this idea that he's okay.
Right.
And I've never seen in my lifetime a situation where of such clear emperor's new clothes dishonesty on the whole societal level as the elevation of Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee. It's just the most insane thing you can imagine. And, you know, and it also speaks to the weird circumstance that we cannot seem to get people of standing to step up to volunteer to lead the country.
I don't blame them.
Yeah, but I mean, there must be plenty of them out there. This is a country of 360 million people. Mm. There must be some fine people out there, some great leaders, mm-hmm. some really upright people. I know a few of them myself, mm-hmm. and yet we can't flush them out of the thickets to be our leaders because the country is in such a state of chronic immersive dishonesty. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's so how are you going to make authority credible is really, I think, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle as well, isn't it? So is it, I mean, the point I was trying to make about the monks and the hierarchy and how the way that we perceive a hierarchy comes from a value set. Well, and then you were answering it with, well, who's in charge? Who's the leader who's establishing the values is essentially what it comes down to. So if that leader of that authority figure is himself dishonest or herself, then they're going to be propagating value sets that are self-serving, that help them. If they're narcissistic, then they're going to be, just basically dishonest. I mean, there's not too much you need to say about that, is there? But then that itself is going to create a hierarchy, which creates a kind of functioning society and economy that then, of course, would promote the wrong people into positions of authority and so on. So you can see how that would snowball until you had an avalanche.
You bet. I mean, eventually, you end up with something that's either like the Nazi hierarchy or the Soviet hierarchy, or just a terrible collection of people.
Yeah. Yeah. So back to my own felt sense that the only sane option is to disengage and to focus on the people that one can connect to and work with, and just try to rediscover a way of living together in the midst of all this chaos and just hope for the best.
Yeah, to do your best and be consciously an honest person and a reality-based person. And of course, when I say that, I mean, that brings into question what is one of the primary failures of our time in the USA anyway, which is to construct a coherent consensus about what reality is and what the values are that we append to that reality. And we're just absolutely unable to construct that coherent consensus, which is also known as a common culture. Of course, if you live in a society that has chosen to dedicate itself to multiculturalism, you're never going to form a common culture. So there's just a fundamental blunder that we made along the way at a certain point in time. It doesn't mean it can't be corrected, and it will be, because it doesn't work. But we did make that blunder, and we're suffering the consequences of that now.
Well, it occurs to me that culture has a lot to do with environment. So different cultures are different because the human beings are growing out of a different natural environment. So if you try and create a monoculture, you're basically mashing a bunch of things together, different cultures and different types of human being, in a way that would create some awful kind of Dr. Moreau hybrid monster.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think that... a common culture can be a very beneficial thing, and it's really a matter of synthesis of different parts into something that is perhaps stronger and better than the pieces of it. Mm. I mean, that's exactly what American common culture of the early mid-20th century was, and one of the reasons we look back on it with such nostalgia and awe is how solid it was, you look at these 1930s movies, and I've been looking at a lot of them recently on the old movie channel here in the States, the Turner Classic Movies, and just to notice the difference in behavior between the people on the screen in 1935 and the people who are around us now. and their representation in modern movies. It's astounding. It's astounding to see the difference in relations between men and women, and and what was considered to be reality back then.
Right.
And the breakdown is very obvious. You know, what has become a breakdown in so much consensual reality.
Yeah. Well, because that was the early days, wasn't it? It was the experiment, the American experiment, I mean.
Well, it was earlier than we are now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's only been a matter of a few hundred years. I'm reading a novel now that's set in the Rome of 380 A.D. There are a lot of things about the empire that are unraveling badly, but it's still, pretty much all there.
Right.
And, the characters in the novel are waxing poetically about the long ago figures of, Augustus and Julius Caesar and the Republic, for them, that's almost 400 years in the past.
Right.
That's deep, way deeper than, the USA goes. So, it's kind of eye-opening to me.
Well, I think there's been an acceleration, hasn't there? I mean, there's various different ways we can see it, but obviously industrialization and technology is the most obvious way, and growing population, something that's been accelerating.
Yeah.
And so we could say the symptoms is the thing that has been accelerating, even though it wouldn't have only been that to begin with.
And I think the pain that we're feeling now in this very sudden contraction with the virus and the the kind of long emergency, as I call it, conditions of the economic crack up that was going, was underway before the virus.
Yeah.
What we're seeing is the pain of deceleration.
Yeah. Well, isn't that, the image that came to mind is the last moments before a crash when everything seems to slow down. Like when you drop a plate and time seems to stand still.
Right. Or you're in an automobile and you see the guardrail coming at you and you're sliding on it sideways.
Yeah, and you've got all this time to think, but no time to do anything.
That is what Eudora Welty called a still moment.
Yeah. Time to contemplate eternity.
Well, it is, and I've actually got to go contemplate eternity.
It's going to be a meta question now because you won't have time to answer it, but I wanted to ask if you were ready to talk about oil and the situation with oil. So
have you
been working on this? But I mean, because the price of oil has gone down to below zero and it's this very strange situation from what I picked up. So is that something you're looking into and that you...
Oh, yeah. I wrote quite a bit about it in the new book, Living in the Long Emergency. Yeah, 15 years ago, the peak oil theory was pretty simple. You get to a certain point where you've gotten half the oil out of the ground, and from there on it gets more difficult, and the price goes up, and it just goes up and up, and you can't afford it anymore.
Yeah.
And that was a simple model. Nah, the model turns out to not be that quite that simple, because it's certainly not about running out of oil. We've got plenty of oil. It's about the dislocations that occur when the energy cost of energy, that is the cost of the energy cost of getting the energy out of the ground, comes to a ratio that no longer makes it possible to run your advanced society. And then all kinds of strange things happen.
Right.
And so now the strange thing has happened is that the price has fallen out under the oil commodity. And a lot of people weren't expecting it. There are a few people out there who understood it very clearly. One of them was the great Gail Tverberg, T-V-E-R-B-E-R-G, who writes the blog Our Finite World. And she called this years ago. She said, you know, one of the possibilities of the oil crisis, the final oil crisis, would be low prices, not high prices.
Right.
And it would reflect the destruction to the economies that occurred when the energy price of energy got out of hand. And it would mean that it would entail a tremendous amount of demand destruction so that people wouldn't be able to afford to buy whatever oil was on the market. Now, the whole shale oil thing is another part of the picture that's complex and interesting. After, you know, in 2008, we were producing about a little bit under 5 million barrels a day in America. And we were importing about 15 million barrels a day to run our society. We consumed about 20 million barrels a day. And that was really wrecking us. And that set of predicaments led to a run-up in the price in 2008 of about $140 a barrel. And that tended to crash the economy. I mean, there's a basic equation that, you know, oil over $75 a barrel destroys economies, and oil under $75 a barrel destroys oil companies.
Right.
And so what happened then was, the industry, first of all, the Federal Reserve and the banking sector in America, the whole financial sector, turned to this kind of stunt, the government too, in concert with them, of covering our current costs by racking up more and more debt. And in the process of doing that, they instituted ultra-low, near-zero interest rate policies. Mm-hmm. And that led to an orgy of lending low interest rate loans, which led to the predictable misallocation of resources and capital. And so we entered the shale oil miracle. And the shale oil miracle was based on enormous amounts of borrowed money that were used to undertake this highly technical, very complex drilling and fracking process where you fracture the tight rock to get the oil out. Mm-hmm. Now, a simple way of understanding this is the old conventional oil, it was pretty straightforward. Each well back in, let's say, 1950 in Texas, you know, you sink an oil well, it costs $400,000 in today's money to drill the well. It's like sticking a straw in the ground. The oil comes out under its own pressure. And when the pressure of the gas stops, you just put a pump jack there and just keep on pumping, and it runs like a cash register. Mm-hmm. You know, it produces thousands of barrels of oil for decades. Okay, and so it's a great venture. It's you get a lot of oil back for each barrel of oil worth of energy that you put into the enterprise. Well, shale oil is way different. It costs not $400,000 a well, but between $6 and $12 million per well in today's money. The shale wells produce average of about maybe 100 or so barrels a day, not thousands of barrels a day. And they only last for, the first year they draw down to 60% of production, and after about 3 years are totally gone, not decades. So it's a very different business. It's very expensive. You don't get as much oil out of the ground for the amount of energy that you're investing in the whole process. And what happened was the shale oil producers just performed a miraculous stunt. They raised American oil production from a low 4-point-something million barrels a day to 13 million barrels a day in 2019. And that was 3 million barrels a day higher than the previous peak in 1970. It was a tremendous stunt. But they didn't make a red cent doing it. And in the course of that 10 years of doing it, they demonstrated that they were not a good investment. And so all of that investment that they burned up to perform that stunt, they're not going to get any new investment. Now, having demonstrated that they can't make money, they will not get new investment to continue the stunt. And to make matters worse, the crisis in shale oil now is combining with the long emergency in finance generally and the debt bubble bursting to produce a situation that will result in the evaporation of capital. So the capital won't even be there to lend out to continue the shale oil operation. So I hope I haven't been blathering on too much about it, but the bottom line is the shale oil miracle was a great stunt. It was done completely with borrowed money that will never be paid back in a situation that has turned into a debt bubble crisis. It will not be repeated. The shale oil miracle is probably over, and we're now entering the next chapter of the oil story, which will be the final contraction of the oil industry. Hmm. And that's the story.
And is there another element here? Because I get this from my wife. But with Saudi and China producing oil and flooding the market, combining with the COVID crisis and nobody's using oil, so that all these barrels are being created that they can't sell and they can't stop the pumping. So that's why
Well, they will stop the pumping. That's the thing. You know, this is a very temporary situation, and it's a, you know, it's a market abnormality. But what will happen very soon in the USA is that the shale oil wells will be shut in, as they call closing up the wells, shut right. in.
Yeah.
They'll do that because, you know, they have no choice. Either they're going to just spill the oil onto the landscape because there's nowhere to put it,
yeah.
or they're going to stop the pumping.
Yeah.
And they're going to do it. They're going to shut them in. And another wrinkle on this story is that once you shut in the wells, it's very difficult and expensive to restart them.
Right.
And having reduced or little access to future capital for doing this because they're bad investments, they're not going to be restarted. And so that's where that is. I believe you said Saudi Arabia and China.
Yeah,
Saudi
Russia.
Arabia and Russia.
I realized that, yeah.
I think what will probably happen is that the Saudi oil situation is kind of mysterious. We don't know where they really are in terms of, their reserves. It's a very secretive thing. But they also have a very abnormal society over there. And what will probably happen is that the Saudi Arabian nation will crack up one way or another as a result of the disorders in the oil market. I think the Russians are probably in the better position because they have quite a bit of oil left. They're not dependent on fracking. And to some extent, they can husband their own oil for their own uses and their own purposes to maintain their own civilization, their own society on a very large piece of land that tends to be somewhat isolated from the other places in the world. They certainly become economically isolated because of all the sanctions and things. So they've had some experience now in isolation, and it may be a virtue for them to have all that oil at their disposal. You know, we're not going to be so lucky. And having created a system in the USA that is almost entirely composed of suburban sprawl now, or metroplex megacities that are enormously energy dependent, we're going to have a lot of trouble retuning our civilization to the new realities of energy.
Yeah, you made that point earlier on about the loss of community having to do with oil, as in how much a barrel of oil can produce industry as compared to once upon a time we relied on human beings. there's one theory to going around, I think it might be a joke, but I'm not sure, which is that they're going to figure out ways that they can use human beings to generate energy, as in with bicycles and stuff, while they're confined to their homes, and so create, and that would of course be a way for human beings to make money.
Yeah.
So literally turning us into batteries.
You know, I think more what you'll see in the way of human energy will be more like, 12th century serfdom.
Hmm. Yeah, that's the techno-narcissistic equivalent of that, isn't it? It's having video game addicts on exercise bikes powering the industry.
Yeah, human gerbils. And I want to plug my book one last time.
Go ahead.
It's called Living in the Long Emergency by Ben Bella Books. It's available at, bookstores. Please support your independent booksellers. Of course, you can get it at other places. You can order it on my website from my local bookseller, who will send it to you autographed. In fact, I'm going in to autograph a bunch of them tomorrow. And drop into my twice weekly blog, Clusterfuck Nation. It comes out every Monday and Friday morning at 10 o'clock on the dot Eastern time, 7 o'clock in the morning your time on the West Coast. You might also be interested in my four novel series under the rubric of the World Made by Hand novels. That's World Made by Hand was the first one, and The Witch of Hebron, A History of the Future, and The Harrows of Spring. They are four novels set in a small town following a collapse of the North American economy. And they're very vivid. They've got a lot of comedy in them, but they're also, I think an interesting portrait of what the future may hold for us. So that's it. Thanks for having me here, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, Jason.
Likewise, Jim. To begin with, the things that you end with, changes in the heart, change with the times. And there ends my latest conversation with James Howard Kunstler. For Jim's blog and to order his books, go to the link in the show notes. For those who don't already know, I'm doing a fundraising campaign for 16 Maps of Hell with a rough draft of The Exit, The Unraveling of Hollywood Superculture, which will be a roughly 600-page book, and if I raise enough funds, also an audiobook, possibly even a hardback edition. Currently up to just over £3,000, just over the halfway point there. It's only been going for a week. So it looks promising, and if you would like to know more about 16 Maps of Hell, just go to the link in the sidebar, and if you want to support it, pick an option and click on the button. Thanks everyone who has supported this campaign so far. It's going very well, and I'm very optimistic about the chances that this book will be out and about by September or October 2020. This is the Liminalist, the podcast between you have now listened.